From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Documentarian Jonas Poa Rasmussen long wanted to tell the story of his friend who fled Afghanistan as a child and ended up alone in a Danish town as a teenager. But that friend didn't want his identity revealed, and there was no footage of his journey. The answer was animation, but it wasn't cheap.
In the beginning, when we started doing the financing, we had a lot of people saying, well, this sounds wonderful. And then they saw the budget and they said, well, this can't be done. So it was really a long time, like slowly finding more and more funds.
Rasmussen tells us about his years-long quest to document his friend's incredible story and explains how he hopes his movie Flea, Denmark's submission to the Oscars this year, can influence hearts and minds on the current refugee crisis in Europe. But first, we banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my associate banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So we don't know how the numbers will come out finally for West Side Story, which is going to be opening just after we finish this conversation. But this is a movie that's facing some challenges, despite the fact that people, many of whom were very skeptical, including me, I will acknowledge, that Steven Spielberg, with the help of Tony Kushner and the screenplay, should be remaking a classic, classic film. It appears that Spielberg has really executed on this one. The reviews are great. I've talked to people from inside of the business and journalists who have seen it. I haven't yet, who are just over the moon about how fantastic it is. And yet, you know, audiences are still not streaming back into theaters. This is a movie aimed at older audiences, although I do know one producer who saw it who thinks that it will ultimately attract young women because it's a romantic story with asterisks in terms of the male lead having some reputation problems that have been, you know, out there involving a long ago relationship. So maybe they will, but if it is older audiences, they are not streaming back. And this movie doesn't have that big of a window to establish that it will be able to play and play and play in theaters.
Yeah, and that's the big question. First of all, who is this movie made for? You know, the audience, like you said, is older, and those are exactly the people that have not returned to theaters. The release date is bizarre as well, because it's mid-December when a lot of people are still involved with holiday parties and shopping. Usually the big holiday movies come out next weekend. And because of the logjam this year and all these movies that have been delayed and pushed and were scheduled for this time because the thinking was that COVID would be on the downside, there's a lot of competition, most notably from the Spider-Man sequel next weekend, which is coming out from Sony, but with participation from Disney. And that movie is expected to be a monster. So we are taping before it comes out, but if the opening weekend is in the teens or less, or even single digits, there's a good chance that this movie could disappear very quickly. And that's not what Disney wants, because they want this to play during the holidays and then the awards kick in. And then by the time we get to the Oscars, you look up and it's like, whoa, this movie's made a couple $100 million. And I just think that's a little bit of an outdated thinking for these types of movies in the current environment, especially when this movie costs more than $100 million. They are copping to $100 million, but my sources have said it's more like 130.
It may be. I mean, it looks like a big movie. And I will say Steven Spielberg has now a well-established reputation for working very efficiently. So even that number for something like this is not a crazy number. I don't know whether Disney would have done this. They inherited this when they bought Fox, but you know, Steven Spielberg, maybe. I will just recall, like, 5 years ago, I did a cover story on Steven Spielberg for The Hollywood Reporter. And at that time he said, you know, I only have so many movies left in me. And I thought, you know, I didn't think of him as being that old. I mean, Spielberg is 74. He's a very vital man. And I have to say, I when I heard he was doing West Side Story, I and many others thought, this is your choice when you have a finite number of movies left in you. But I have to just pay respect to him, because there was so much skepticism and there were so many cultural issues. You know, this was based on some outmoded stereotypes in the original, on non-Puerto Rican actors playing Puerto Rican people. There was a lot to navigate. And to their credit, Steven Spielberg and Tony Kushner appear to have totally dealt with, you know, this question, why are two older white men making a movie about immigrants in New York? And it just seems that they executed. So in a way, I mean, we did see Dear Evan Hansen and Cats go through the thresher. And I have to say, I feel like it would be a bit of a shame if that happens to this.
Well, behind the scenes, Spielberg and Tony Kushner actually did some significant outreach to that community. They went to Puerto Rico in December of 2019 and actually met with cultural leaders there and said, this is what we're doing. There were significant changes from the original book in the new screenplay that got rid of a lot of those stereotypes. There is now a Rita Moreno character who, you know, she was in the original and she is playing a very prominent character. They also cast Latin actors to play the Puerto Ricans, which, you know, you would think would have happened 60 years ago, but did not. So they have absolutely made strides to update this movie for the times while keeping it what it is.
Yes. I'm going to turn quickly to this thing having to do with the proposed Discovery takeover of Warner Media. More than 30 Democrats in Congress have raised concerns. They wrote a letter to Merrick Garland and the Justice Department saying that they feel that this raises significant antitrust concerns and should face some scrutiny from the Justice Department. I have to say, based on the state of this industry, you know, as we have discussed in the past, Discovery and Warner's, they have some commonality, but Discovery does a lot of reality programming and Warner's is in all kinds of different stuff. I just find, you know, you can have concerns about the number of people who are potentially going to lose their jobs, although you could argue that if AT&T holds on to Warner Media, a lot of people will still lose their jobs. But framing it as an antitrust thing, I feel like, do these Democrats follow what is going on in this industry?
No, but often that isn't the rationale for these kinds of letters. And, you know, as we see with these ridiculous hearings that keep happening over the tech industry, some of the concerns that are raised, like when the Republicans say that Facebook censors conservative content when the statistics show the exact opposite, you know, this is all politics. And that's the thing with antitrust regulation is that you have to be concerned that these companies are going to be targets for political reasons. And I just don't know. I mean, there's two of these. There's the Warner Media Discovery deal, and then there's the Amazon MGM deal. And I think both of them are vulnerable to this anti-corporate, anti-big media tech feeling that is reverberating throughout Washington right now.
Well, I'm just going to say that I find it ironic that Disney and Fox, which truly consolidated the industry, goes by without a murmur. Of course, that was during the Trump administration, and it was the Murdochs that wanted it. And then these two, which to me, I mean, you know, Warner's MGM is really a sort of a distressed asset that is not exactly some big player in the industry. And Warner Media needs to be rescued from AT&T if it's going to go forward and be a thriving entity, arguably. So, you know, just seems a little ironic that they are focusing on that instead of whatever would be more germane to the situation we find ourselves in. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, a founding partner of Puck News. Early in the new animated documentary, Flea, Danish director Jonas Poer Rasmussen asks his friend Amin to close his eyes and take a deep breath.
Så hvis du ligesom lukker øjnene nu,
ja,
og prøver at trække vejret sådan dybt ind.
From there, Amin starts talking about his childhood in Kabul, a life that was disrupted first by the Soviet occupation and then withdrawal. After her husband was arrested, Amin's mother packed up with her children and escaped to Moscow. But that was hardly a safe haven, and the family took great risks as they struggled to get to Europe. Eventually, at 15, Amin ended up alone in a small Danish town. That's where he met Rasmussen, who was a schoolmate, and the two have been friends ever since. Flea tells Amin's story through long interviews overlaid with animation that changes in style depending on Amin's emotional state. Amin is actually a pseudonym, as Rasmussen's friend wants to keep his identity secret for reasons laid out in the film. Rasmussen had hoped to tell Amin's story for years, and given the challenges it presented, initially thought the way to do it would be through radio.
I actually thought I was going to do radio from way back. I had a radio program, radio station in my primary school when I was like 12, 13 years old.
I have to pause on that. What did you do with your radio station when you were 12 years old?
No, but you know, it's just like doing interviews with the local kind of janitor and the going to the baker and like doing interviews with people in the little village in the city. I did local interviews and played music and did like hit lists and people could vote for their favorite songs and stuff.
Okay, you were a young sort of journalist DJ, I guess, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I always listened to radio a lot. And then I went to this talent course and I did a lot of radio documentaries. And a part of that, you actually see in the film, you know, this technique of interviewing is something you learn in Denmark. Denmark has a quite big tradition for doing radio documentaries. And in the film, you see a minister laying down. He has his eyes closed and talks in present tense. And that's really a technique from I learned back then when I did radio. Because when you do radio, you obviously don't have an image. So you really need your subject to be very descriptive in the way of talking. And in Danish, it's called moment interview. So like interview of the moment. So it's really about creating presence. So every time Amin in the film starts talking about a certain memory, I always start out with asking him to describe the location he's in. So in the beginning of the film, he's in his childhood home in the garden with his siblings. And I would then ask him, like, what did the garden look like? What kind of plants are there? Is there any trees? What flowers are there? What are the colors on the walls? What does the house look like? And all this, you know, gives a lot of information for the animators to work with, but also kind of brings him back. So he's more present in the memory and he kind of talks in a more present way.
Right. Well, it's almost like therapy, the way you have him at certain points, he's like lying down with his eyes closed and remembering visual images. I'm almost expecting, you know, I'm so sorry our time is up now, because as a viewer, I felt like it looked like therapy sessions at times.
Yeah, yeah, I guess it kind of was. I didn't realize when I started, it really came from this technique of interviewing. But when we started out, he said that this was going to be therapy for him. You know, sharing his story was something he needed to do.
Well, so let's roll backwards. I think, so you're a kid in school, a 15-year-old or something, I think, when you encounter this person who's, I guess, struck you as maybe a little mysterious. This is a schoolmate of yours.
Yeah, so I was 15. I grew up in this very small, rural Danish village, I would say, like 500 people in it. And one day, Amin arrived. And, you know, he was very fashionable. He cared a lot about fashion. And people in my city really, really didn't. and we didn't have a lot of migrants or refugees at the time. You know, this is back in the 90s. So he was definitely exotic. And I really wanted to get to know him when I saw him. And then he learned Danish really fast. And, you know, we started meeting up at the bus stop every morning going to high school and became very good friends. So that's kind of where it started. And of course, already back then, I was curious about how and why he had gotten to my village. But he didn't want to talk about it. So I, of course, respected that. And, you know, being a 15-year-old boy, you just kind of like, okay. And then we'll just kind of hang out instead. So he just didn't say anything to anyone for more than 20 years.
And of course, he has a harrowing backstory, but somehow he presents as a regular kid.
Yeah. You know, I never realized how much he carried around till he shared the story and how much it affected him in everything he's done through his life. Because he was very well functioning, you know, and he was very good in school. You know, he got way better grades than I did in high school and helped me out with my Latin class. And like, he's just a really hard worker. So he made things work, even though he had all these things he carried around.
And then at what point do you say to him, hey, what about a documentary? And I'm assuming that I read that you were initially thinking radio documentary because that was your thing.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's like 15 years ago, I asked him if I could do a radio documentary about his story, about his past. And, you know, he said that he didn't feel ready to share his story. But he also said that he knew that he would have to at some point. It was something he felt like he needed to do. And when he was ready, he would share it with me. He actually had other people reaching out as well who was interested in his story.
I mean, was he attracting notice from other journalists?
Yeah, exactly. So because he did so well. Like he was in academia and did very well and went to an Ivy League university over here in the States. So people kind of wanted to know if they could, you know, write a book and include him about how to integrate well, how well-integrated refugees in Denmark and how they did. But he said no and said when he was ready, he would like to share his story with me. And then that took another 8 years.
8 years. I mean, I know that feeling when somebody promises you an interview and then you think, is he really going to remember me, or is somebody else going to come along with a, you know, highly tempting offer? But I think probably part of the whole thing for him would be this anonymity, right? That he did not want to be known publicly.
Exactly. Like he told me from the very beginning that he doesn't like that look on himself. You know, he doesn't like to be victimized. And he's like, yes, I went through some harrowing things. I've experienced a lot of really bad things, but I'm not a victim. I'm not just a refugee. This is a life circumstance. It's a situation that I went through, and I'm going to carry this around for so long, for the rest of my life. But I don't want to be victimized. I don't want people to look at me like a victim. So the fact that he could keep anonymity and still start on a clean slate when he meet people, that people don't know his innermost secrets and his traumas when they meet him, was really important, was kind of key for him to start to open up.
Right. And I mean, did you have reservations about it, or did you just say, I understand that and I'm good with it?
No, you know, for the very first, like the first year or so, I think we just agreed on, okay, but we don't know where it is heading. Like, we're just going to try it out. And I was like, okay, we're going to try to create like a safe space where you feel you can talk about your past. And if it doesn't work for you, you can always walk out and say, this isn't working. And that's like a back door. So in the beginning, it was just about creating a conversation where we both felt, okay, but this works. This is something we can work with. And then, of course, when we started to get funding for the project, we kind of had to look each other in the eye and said, okay, are you good with this? Can we do this? And we both had a feeling that, okay, but he felt safe and I felt that I could work with the story and the testimony he was giving me.
Well, I assume that the idea of animation was totally essential. Otherwise, you would have had to do a silhouette the whole entire time, I guess. And of course, there are a lot of images that you couldn't find in an archive. You did find something unusual, Kabul before the Soviet occupation footage, but a lot of this stuff, there's no image at all. So tell me how the idea of animating all of that came about.
You know, since I had the idea for the radio documentary, and I asked him, and he said, we can do this at some point. The idea kind of stuck in the back of my head. And I was then invited for this workshop in Denmark called AniDocs, where they combine animators and documentary filmmakers to develop ideas for animated documentaries. And they called me up. They'd seen some of my previous films. And they called me up and asked me if I had an idea for an animated doc. And because I had a Mince story in the back of my head, I thought, okay, but maybe this is the way to do it. So actually, the film was thought as an animation film from the very beginning. And I then asked them if he would want to share his story and it would become an animated doc. And he said yes, and he felt it was a good time for him to finally share his story. And also, yeah, he was very intrigued by the possibilities of being anonymous behind the animation. And, you know, with the animation, I also thought, okay, but most of the story takes place in the past. So animation really enabled us to kind of revitalize the past and, you know, recreate his childhood home, recreate the area he lived in when he was a kid, and kind of place him there. So it was very intriguing possibilities in working with animation.
So how many years ultimately do you work on this?
The first interview I did with him, I listened to the very beginning of it quite recently, actually. And he had a conversation with my wife. All the interviews was done in my home. And I could hear him in and my wife kind of having a conversation. And she was pregnant. So it must be like 7 years ago, the first interview we did. And then, you know, it was a slow process because this is my first animated film. So I really needed to learn the process of making animation. And also it was tough to finance because animation is quite expensive and we've had to finance it in the documentary world where there's not a lot of money. It's getting better, but compared to animation, there's a lot of money. So it took a long time, but it was really beneficial for the process because I had to learn animation and we had to find a visual style that kind of fit it with the testimony Amin gave us. And also Amin, you know, slowly had to open up more and more and be ready to share everything. So it was a slow process starting 7 years ago. And then here we are.
Yeah, the financing. I noticed there's a long list of institutions and organizations. You have really pulled together, it looks like, all kinds of sources for financing.
Yeah, my producer has done an amazing job in financing this film. Like in the beginning, when we started doing the financing, we had a lot of people saying, well, this sounds wonderful. And they saw the budget and they said, well, this can't be done. So it was really it was really a long time, like slowly finding more and more funds. And then we had Arte France, which is like a big European TV network, came on board, put down quite a lot of money. And that really helped us to open up other funds. And slowly we could finance the whole thing.
Coming up after a short break, Jonas Poer-Rasmussen explains why working on an animated documentary meant he had to reverse his usual filmmaking process. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to director Jonas Poer-Rasmussen about his new documentary, Flea, which is now in theaters in New York and L.A. and will have a wider release in January. Flea is Denmark's submission to compete for Best International Film at the Oscars this year, and it could also get nominated for Best Documentary and Best Animated Film. Flea tells the story of how Amin Nawabi, that's not his real name, was pushed out of his childhood home in Afghanistan, and after taking his chances at the hands of human traffickers, ended up in Denmark, alone, as a teenager, in the 90s. Amin had never told his story to anyone, not even his partner, Kasper. When he finally agreed to share it with Rasmussen, he wanted to remain anonymous. Rasmussen handled that and other challenges of telling the story of Amin's journey through animation, which was a new medium for him.
You know, the process of doing animation is very, very different, both from live action and documentary, because normally you go out, you know, you go out and shoot, and then you go back to the editing room and you really kind of build your story from the material you shot. But here it's very different because it's animation and you have to edit before you start animating anything because animation is so expensive. So you can't animate, you know, 30 hours of material and then do the edit. You have to do the edit first. So you do the edit in these very rough storyboards and put it all together and make sure the edit is locked before you start animating as a single frame, which is very different, of course, because it's just the opposite way. But what it does is it really gave a lot of freedom that I hadn't experienced before in the edit, because all of a sudden, you know, normally you're a slave of the material you shot. And then if you're doing a scene, but you didn't shoot, you know, the close-up shot of one of the characters, then too bad, like you just have to work around it. But here, all of a sudden, you could just ask the storyboard artist, oh, I need a close-up shot, or I need a mood shot of some birds flying by. And then they would just provide you with it in the edit, which gave you a lot of freedom and you could really be precise in the way of shaping the story.
Yeah. Now, I had read that you wanted this perfect accuracy in terms of time and location, what kind of pot is on the stove, the quality of a sunset, the height of a street curb even. Why was that so important?
You know, I was given this testimony by Amin, and it's a real story. It's a documentary story, and it needs to feel like that. So to me, it wouldn't make sense if Afghanistan, if Kabul in the 80s didn't feel like Kabul in the 80s, if people who actually lived there wouldn't recognize it. It kind of would take away the authenticity from the testimony. So it was super important for me that because you have this testimony underneath all the animation, that the animation kind of supports that. So Jess Nichols and me and Kenneth Lillicker, who's the art director, we spend a lot of time just doing research, you know, just going through books in the library, going through archival footage and just picking things and putting it in there. And we also had a group of local Afghans who would look through things we did and made sure that things looked correct. I remember one of our consultants at some point said, that's a gas stove. We didn't have gas in Kabul, so you couldn't have a gas stove. So you needed an electrical one instead. So I think, of course, we could have gotten away with having one or two mistakes. But I think overall, to be as precise as we could was kind of key to keep authenticity and to make sure that this felt like a documentary.
And at the same time, I saw a quote, you said, we tried to stay true to the emotion rather than being realistic about what happened. And I wasn't quite sure how to understand that.
But there are times in the film and there's times in the testimony where you can sense that Amin's voice kind of changed when he starts to talk about something that's traumatic or where he has a hard time remembering exactly what happened. He started to talk slower and there was like pauses between the words. And I thought, okay, but we need to see this because now it's not about what things look like. now it's about his emotion. Now he's back in this position where he feels scared, or he feels angry, or he feels sad. So really trying to show these things, show his emotions at times. And that was really powerful and something we could do with the animation that we wouldn't be able to do with a live action camera, to kind of dive into his inside and trying to show what he felt like.
Right. And I understand. So the film is Denmark's submission to the Oscars this year. And Denmark won last year with another round, I think, Best International Film. But you were eligible in multiple Best Animated, Best International, and Best Documentary. So you've got three shots, three bites potentially of that apple. But no pressure, right? It's fine.
Yeah. No pressure. You know, I try not to think too much about that because it's just going to drive me crazy. But it's of course amazing. And with every recognition the film gets and every award it gets, it just reaches a broader audience. And I'm just very happy about that.
How is Amin reacting to all of this?
He's, like me, overwhelmed by all of it. You know, he's very happy with the film. So the fact that the reception has been so great really means a lot to him. I think he was a little concerned that people wouldn't be able to relate to his story because, you know, he's kind of double marginalized, being both a refugee and being gay. So the fact that people relate to his story and it resonates with the people across the world means a big deal to him.
I have to say that I sort of wondered whether people aren't just spending time trying to figure out who he is, which would be unfortunate, but maybe a very human impulse for some people to be curious.
Yeah, maybe. I hope that people will respect that he really wants anonymity. You know, there's no kind of legal issues around him. So it's just for him to kind of being able to keep living his life. And you know, he has a professional career and he really wants to be able to meet people on a clean slate and not having to face questions about his past and his traumas, because it's not easy for him to talk about.
Right.
So I of course can't control that, but I really hope that people will respect his wish for anonymity.
And of course, your film, unfortunately, is as relevant now as it could possibly be, because we've just seen, you know, Europe being pulled apart by this fighting over this issue of refugees and tragedies around refugees. And I'm sure that that's pretty grim, considering, you know, you'd hope for some kind of progress, but we aren't seeing much.
Yeah, you know, it's just sad to see, you know, and also how the rhetoric has changed throughout the years now for many, many years. You know, when Amin arrived in Denmark in the 90s, you know, he was given asylum and he was told that he could stay. And, you know, that kind of allowed him to be able to build a life for himself because he felt safe. And now, you know, refugees coming now, they're kind of put in these different centers and they're being told that, okay, you can stay for now, but as soon as we get the chance, we're going to send you back. So this kind of sense of temporarity, like, you can't build anything on that. And just, yeah, it's sad to see that we don't trust people and that we haven't learned that, like, I mean, as an example, like, really how valuable it is to show trust in someone and how that kind of pays back in the end. So yeah, what I'm really hoping with this film is that it will give some perspective to what's going on now and will give, you know, refugees a human face. Because this is told from the inside of a friendship, I had the possibility to give a lot more nuance to the refugee story than normally. A lot of the time, refugees are just described by what they need. But, you know, being a refugee isn't an identity. It's something that could happen to everyone. So I'm really hoping that the film will give some perspective to the situation in Europe and the world right now.
Jonas Poer Rasmussen is the director of the documentary Flee. Thank you very much for joining us and explaining how this film came to be.
Thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Paul Smith, who also mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.